This is David's Book Talk, bringing authors and book lovers together in a unique way since 2009. Visit us at davidsbooktalk.com and join the conversation at facebook.com/davidsbooktalk. But first, pull up a chair, relax, and enjoy today's episode. Here's your host, David English.
Hello and welcome again to David's Book Talk. Today we're going to talk to Matthew Sullivan. He has written, this is his first novel, first big published novel, called Midnight at the Bright Ideas Bookstore, which is just published from Scribner, I think on June 13th it was. Hello, how are you?
I'm good. Thank you so much for calling me, David. I appreciate it.
You have a good sense of humor. I can tell it already just from talking to you before we started this. And humor is so important nowadays. And without humor, where would we be?
Right.
If we can't find something to laugh hysterically about, and laughing is so good for the soul. I mean, it's just
it's definitely a pastime of mine. I dig it.
So I don't know where I first heard about this book. This is the first novel, and it is really terrific. And I'm noticing now.
I really appreciate that.
I'm noticing now there's a hangman's noose on one of the books on the cover, and I didn't notice that before.
yeah. There are these little darker elements kind of tucked in there. I think the hangman's noose is one of them, and I think just the black cover, the looming darkness behind the bright books. There's some sinister elements to it, I think, if you look.
I read this book. I was having dinner with my book club, and this was a couple weeks ago. And I got there very early because I didn't think I was going to be able to find the place that we were eating. And they didn't show up for a cool few hours, so I had a few hours to kill. I read your book, and God, I was so into it. I thought, I don't even care if my group comes. I just want to read this book.
I'm glad I can contribute to your antisocial behaviors there, David.
But it is like, it wasn't that I didn't want to see them. It was that I was so absorbed in the book. And you know how you get into a book, you don't want to stop reading.
Oh, yeah. And you kind of forget what time it is, and everything kind of falls to the wayside.
And you look, and it's, great. It's 3 in the morning. I must be enjoying this book.
Right.
But I mean, it's fun to read late at night, especially if it's like rainy or... especially if it's raining. I don't know why reading a book while it's raining is so enjoyable to me. I have no idea why.
Yeah.
Call me twisted, but that...
Yeah, it's all that atmosphere kind of building up. It's in the back of your mind, and you kind of hear it, and you're absorbed in it. Yeah, I get it. I'm with you there for sure.
Really? You don't think I'm crazy?
No, I really don't. I'm a big fan of the rain.
So what would it be like if you had your own bookstore and you walked up to the upper level of your bookstore and somebody had hanged themselves? That's the premise of this book. I mean, that is just...
Yeah.
I mean, it's not what I think about when I go to a bookstore, that's for sure.
Right. I guess, a big part of what I was setting out to do was to balance some darkness with some light. And so I guess I think of the bookstore itself and the world of books and booksellers and all that as the kind of lighter part and the kind of, sanctuary part of it. And then, of course, because it's crime fiction and I'm interested in crime fiction, then you got to have something like that happen, something dark entering into it and disrupting the sanctuary and, disrupting the little Eden of the bookstore. And so, so that was conscious to have that kind of interruption there to the peace that the main character had found in the bookstore. So
And these messages that he sends her, and you when you read them in the book, you're like, what does that say? Thank God you translated afterwards. I might have had trouble figuring out what they are.
yeah, and that's something that I wasn't totally certain about how to handle that because I wanted them in there, but then of course you don't want a book to become difficult to read.
Right.
As soon as a reader has to stop and like get out their little secret decoder ring and try to figure something out, you run the risk of taking them out of the story, right?
Oh yeah, so, absolutely.
So I guess the answer to that was to kind of keep them fairly minimal in the story, and then also, spell them out.
Yeah, it's very unusual.
By and large.
You probably won't see that in any other book published for years.
Yeah, maybe. That was it took some work to get to that, to kind of figure out exactly what I wanted to do with the books. I knew that I wanted them to be defaced, and I knew that I wanted them to be kind of encrypted with this story that kind of is maybe, I don't want to give too much away, but in the past of the character. But it did take a while to arrive at what you read when you read it. There were some kind of missed attempts there. Let's put it that way.
So when you worked at you worked at two different bookstores, or was it were there more?
Just two.
Brookline Booksmith, and also what was the other one?
Tattered Cover
in Denver. I
actually worked at Tattered Cover for about 4+ years, and then Brookline Booksmith, I worked more part time. Most of the time I was there was part time.
Yeah. Well, were they very different stores to work at?
Yeah. So, they're both kind of institutions in their own way. I was in a very different part of my life in the two different stores that I worked in. So when I worked at Tattered Cover, I was in my 20s. And I had kind of lived in some different places and had some different jobs. And then I moved back to Denver. I grew up in Denver, in Aurora, which is a suburb of Denver. And when I got a job at Tattered Cover, I was really in this mode of having finished my undergraduate degree and really interested in writing and kind of looking for a place and other people who I guess were open-minded and were going to kind of join me on whatever journey I was on in my 20s of exploration and just trying to figure things out. And part of that was books and just learning about new authors and kind of being turned on to different kinds of reading and so on. And so I think, at that stage of my life, I was in a kind of a different place than when I worked at the Brookline Booksmith. When I worked at Booksmith, I had recently gotten married. I had finished graduate school and I was teaching some college classes, but I really loved the bookstore and the bookstore environment. And so I carved out room for it in my life, even though I was working full time, just because I really liked it there and I really liked the people and I liked the store, obviously.
Well, that's one thing. When you work at a bookstore, and I worked at six years at an independent bookstore, you really get to know your customers, and you really, they almost become like part of your family.
Especially
if you recommend a lot of books to them. So it's really kind of nice. It's like having an extended family,
And people that you see frequently, the who come in every morning for the newspaper, or who come in and just come in to talk books, to say, hey, I just read this book of poetry, you should check it out, and they seek you out and you seek them out. And this vibe, I'm sure you experienced this too, this kind of vibe that you see somebody and you're happy to see them, like a customer or a fellow bookseller. And I don't think you always have that in a retail environment or in a
certainly you don't get it in Walmart. Not to knock Walmart, but it's just not the environment that you have that happen, because the Walmart people pretty much keep to themselves. They don't really, unless you know them, you really don't get a familiar sense about those. But a bookstore is different, because you relating to people on a book level, on a reading level, is something special that can never be matched, as far as I'm concerned. I mean, there's just something about it.
Yeah, and I think also just as institutions, bookstores and maybe independent bookstores in particular, they kind of foster community, and I think for a lot of neighborhoods, they're kind of a hub in the neighborhood.
And there's always those weird also, customers too.
There's always that for sure.
The ones in fact, I remember one time when I was working in the bookstore, they finally caught this guy stealing stuff, and You know, they knew he'd been stealing stuff before, and it was so sad to watch him being taken away. You know, and it was just heartbreaking to watch that, because you just can't imagine somebody doing something like that. And
yeah, you know, you open your doors, and sometimes people let you down. You know, and that's the origin story of this book. It's not, you know, literally part of the story anymore, but in the very early drafts of this book, chapter one had Lydia, the main character, chasing a book thief through downtown Denver, and it was based 100% on an experience that I had when I was sitting out at lunch one day, and a guy who I kind of recognized and knew from around the store just came running out of the store with his trench coat kind of packed with books, and he took off through downtown Denver, and we chased him and caught him and got the books back. And it just kind of got me thinking about, you know, what circumstances, you know, this guy was in. It was, you know, on the one hand, it was kind of this happy, you know, celebratory moment where we were like, sweet, we got the books back, yay.
Right.
And you know, we didn't call the cops or anything. We just kind of let him go, and it wasn't like anything violent or anything like that. But, you know, besides that kind of celebration, I don't want to say celebration, but we were kind of, the adrenaline in the moment and so on was kind of like, yeah, sweet. But then the flip side of it was really depressing, and it didn't take long for that to sink in. And it really bothered me that this guy had done that, and it bothered me the books that he stole. Like, I knew that he wasn't going to read them, and I don't know what kind of scam he had going on. But the whole thing was pretty troubling, and it started off as like me writing in my journal, trying to figure out what was this guy doing? Why was he stealing these books? Why would he do that to a place that had, you know, again, opened its doors to him?
And maybe I should just make him a character in my book, you know?
That's how it started out, really.
And he became Joey.
And then, he became like a very early, different version of him, but yeah.
It wasn't his real name, Joey, was it?
No. I never knew the guy's real name, but that's kind of where the idea of these encrypted books came from. Was me kind of just disentangling this question about if this guy's stealing books that he's not going to read, why would he do that? And then I started, of course, the crime fiction part of me took over and was like, well, because there's messages in them, and you know, and then that's where the imagination kind of came.
Yeah, the relationship between Lydia and her father is fascinating. And I can't remember, is her mother in here too?
She's not. No, she's not. She passes away when Lydia's born.
Actually. But Lydia and her father have a very interesting relationship. We find out more about that as the book goes on. But and we sense Lydia's anger, and we don't, you know, we get to know why. There's so much richness in this book. It's so well written, and it's such a story you can just get into and really, really sink your teeth into. But I mean, I still see that image of the guy hanging from the roof of the bookstore. I mean, and it's something you don't forget once you read it, and you just think, what would make somebody finally do that? What would make anybody want to kill themselves? I mean, we all understand despair. I guess we've all despaired at some point in our life.
Sure. Yeah, and it again, it comes back to those questions of why would somebody do this? What kind of circumstances would you know, stack up to put them in such a dark and hopeless place?
Why have you waited so long to write a book? You're so good at it.
thank you so much. That's really nice. That's like a really nice thing to say. Thank you.
It's also true.
So I didn't wait. I really didn't wait so long to write a book. I've been writing since I was in my early 20s, pretty seriously.
But this is your first published novel, though?
This is my first published. So I have two books that I've finished that are in a drawer. And probably will never come out of that.
Why are they there?
I don't know. You know, like,
you're not ashamed of them, obviously, because you just mentioned them.
I know. Can we rewind? No, I don't know. They were part of my growth as a writer. You know, it's all part of what you kind of learn as you go. There's not like a rule book. Like I got an MFA and it was fantastic, and I had wonderful teachers and wonderful peers and stuff in my MFA, my program. And this is at the University of Idaho, you know, little tiny town in northern Idaho. But I picked that town for a reason, because I knew there wasn't going to be a whole lot going on, and it was going to allot me 3 years to focus on writing. And so I guess the point I'm trying to make is that time and growth and all of that, it's all part of it for me anyway. I know other people are like super geniuses and super gifted and all the rest of it. But for me, this has just been a long process of just kind of loving writing and loving reading and kind of gradually picking up things along the way.
What do you think?
Being lucky enough.
Do you think
work with people who are great? Yeah.
Right. Do you think Midnight is better than the two you have in that drawer there? Is that what it is? You think you've evolved into a better writer since those two?
Yeah, I do. I do for sure.
Well, now I'm curious what those two are about. I'm dying to know what they're about.
Yeah, I mean, I think, like, just a short version, one of them was my MFA thesis, and it was a novel that was based on traveling through Vietnam and this kind of pretty, I guess, kind of magic realist crime-ridden kind of journey through Vietnam set in the early 1990s. And then the second one was another literary mystery about a guy who inherits a zoology museum in the middle of nowhere.
That's the one I want to read. I want to read that one.
I'll send you a copy.
Would you really be embarrassed to have me read it?
Yeah, I would.
Why?
Yeah.
I'm curious why.
It's in the drawer. Yeah.
It's in the drawer? Well, you can open the drawer, you know.
I could open the drawer. See, if I would have to, go through it and reread it. And it's not, like, I think that it was, I'm not saying it's a bad book. It was the book that I wrote when I wrote it. You know, so it was kind of, it was a necessary book for when I wrote it, but that doesn't necessarily mean that it's the best for readers. And there are aspects of it that I like. But you know what I don't like about it, actually, in retrospect, is that at the time I was kind of exploring this, like, sad sack male character, and there's something about, like, when I look back on it, there's something about that voice that character, that central character had at the time, that kind of grates on me now. Like, there was something kind of a little bit too
ironic. Couldn't you polish it and publish it? Do you think that would ever happen?
You know, I got other things I'd rather write.
In other words, no, David.
Absolutely not.
You can say no, Matthew. I won't yell at you if you say no.
I'm a middle child. I don't say no.
Oh, really? Well, I'm sort of a half of a middle child. Well, I'm one of seven, but I'm middle in the three older people. I'm the middle of those two.
Okay, cool. So yeah, so I've got three older sisters and one older brother, and then three younger brothers.
And I don't know why I just said that, because I'm really the third oldest, not the second oldest. I don't know why I said that.
Right.
I'm the third oldest.
But you're far enough kind of in the middle that you probably picked up plenty of those traits. If those traits hold true, you know.
Yeah, so it was great for reading, so I could just lose myself in a book, and who cares? There's six other kids to worry about.
Right.
So you didn't have to worry about, David, what are you doing? They knew what I was doing.
They knew what you were doing. That's great.
Now, is your idea to write only mysteries, or are you going to write regular fiction, too?
I write, my short stories are kind of, I guess, tend toward more kind of traditional literary stories. Some of them do, anyway. I also write some kind of strange, kind of, I don't know, fabulous fiction. Not like science fiction, but just kind of strange little stories. And I do that just mostly for fun, kind of dreamlike stories. And then, but I think for the longer pieces, the things that I'm really invested in, there's something about crime fiction that I'm just drawn to. And I think it
would you write?
Mostly has to.
Yeah. Now, this
I think
is,
mostly has to do with the kind of having kind of a core plot or a core scaffolding, and then obviously like the ability to explore, you know, the darker parts of the human condition and so on.
Well, is Lydia going to be back? People are going to fall in love with Lydia. They're going to want to see her back.
I'm working on something else right now, and I tend to kind of just work on the thing that I'm working on. So I don't write it off, but I don't have any immediate plan for that. But that's not like what I want to work on right now. I have thought about very loosely, and I don't know where this will go or if anything will actually happen to it, but I've thought about the character of Detective Moberg. I'm kind of interested in him as a character. So that's something that just, I may explore him further at some point.
It's interesting because when you read a book, sometimes a character will really get under your skin. There's a book out now called The Magpie Murders by Anthony Horowitz. There's a lieutenant in there, and he's only in like one chapter, and he's just fantastic. He's no nonsense. He's very cynical, very very down. He's very very angry at society, the way society. Uh-huh. And it's just a fascinating chapter. And I'm thinking, boy, he would make a great character in a book by himself.
Yeah, and has he doesn't reemerge in the book.
Not really. No, he's in it a little bit, but not much. Not much. It doesn't really center around him. But he's a fascinating character. And just reading that one chapter, I was like, oh, I love this character. What are they going to do with this character?
I keep hearing such good things about that book. My wife is reading it right now, and I'm up next. So
it really is that spectacular. It is really
cool.
An amazing book. And you wonder, when you read a book like that, you think, well, how do people write books? How do you write a great book? I mean, your book is really terrific. I mean, it really is. And I'm not just saying that because I really, when I got into it, I really got into it. And it was just fascinating to see where it was leading. You know, what's going to happen next? What, this poor woman, you know, finding that dead body, she's never going to get over that.
Yeah. And then you discover kind of things about her past as well that are, you know, looming large for her.
So were you writing this book when you worked at the bookstores?
No, this is something that I started long, long after. I had written, like I said, I'd written in my journal about this, chasing the guy who was stealing books in Denver.
Right.
But yeah, this was many, many years later. And I think part of that is, you know, the book's set in Denver, and I haven't lived in Denver since like 1998. And I think just having that distance from it was good for me as a writer. I think that, I've lived in a number of different places, and I find that it's easier for me to write about a place and to kind of try to capture it in my imagination if I'm not living there, if I'm not like walking out my front door and seeing the setting, you know.
Yeah.
That book came later.
Yeah, I was kind of picturing you on your breaks, like writing the book, you know, at the store.
Right.
And I thought, how cool you are at a bookstore. I mean, working at a bookstore is such a wonderful experience, as we talked about.
It really is.
But, I mean, there's just so much to it, as long as you work with the right people. But you always have that one person who wants to take over everything, you know. It's like,
that's at every job, though, you know.
There's always that one person that if you wish they weren't around, you know.
Yeah, there's always one.
It's hard not to have a job where there isn't somebody who really gets under your skin. That's why you become a writer, because then you don't have to worry about that, unless you have a bad editor.
Yeah, you can go and hole up and.
But people don't usually get bad editors, do they?
I didn't. I had an amazing editor. I had, this editor. This book would not be this book without my editor, hands down.
Now, did they actually say to you, this is wrong, this is wrong, you can't have this in there, this and that? Would they give you a list?
Yeah, at one point, this book was pushing 600 pages, and you've read it, so it weighs in. The typeset version is like 330-something pages, something like that. So it was weighing in at 600 pages. There was a whole, like right now there's kind of these two main plot threads, one having to do with the past and one having to do with the present and the bookstore. And at one point there was a third that involved a pretty elaborate backstory with the character Raj. And there was a whole kind of kidnapping aspect to it. And that was a big part of the book for a lot of revisions. And my editor, and the book really wasn't coming together the way that either of us were really happy with, and my editor made this very bold suggestion that was hard to even kind of entertain, which was cutting that third thread and seeing what the book looked like and how I could shore things up that way. And I with a lot of hesitation, I took his advice, and because it wasn't working, it just didn't come together as tightly as either of us wanted it to in the end. And we cut that out, and suddenly these connections began to kind of come together that weren't there otherwise. And that's something that I never would have come up with on my own. And it was hard. Like, don't get me wrong, this was not like, oh, sweet, oh, that's perfect, there's the answer. Like, this was a, you know, a full extra year of revisions and rewriting after Scribner had already picked it up. And so it was difficult to do, but it also was such a good choice, and it was just so insightful that I feel really pretty lucky that he saw that and was able to kind of point me toward that. And I think, I don't know what other writers' experiences are, but to me that strikes me as kind of old-fashioned from what I've heard about some corners of the publishing industry in terms of the level of engagement that an editor might have with an unknown debut author.
Yeah, you kind of think of, like, if John Grisham wanted to keep it in, he'd be able to keep it in because he's such a big name.
But, yeah, for sure.
But you wonder, you know, how much the writer gets. I mean, the writer doesn't always have what they want to have. They want to have the freedom to write anything they want, but when you're just starting out, you kind of have to do what they want you to do just so you can get your foot in the door.
And then, up to a point, yeah.
I mean, and it's, I'm sure it's very frustrating. Now, I, not having been able to read those extra pages, I'm curious what they're like, but I'll never know which is better, this book or that book.
They're in the drawer also, yeah.
Hey, really? Drawer. That drawer has a lot of interesting stuff in it. I hope I never get near your house. I'll be tempted to come in and steal it.
I'm kind of a hoarder.
Are you?
I hoard all
I wonder what else is in that drawer, you know?
Yeah.
You could write a whole book about a drawer that has some, you know?
I catalog it.
It's amazing what doesn't, and you wonder sometimes what doesn't get into a book. I remember.
Oh, yeah.
I remember I was reading an ARC one time, and I loved the ending of it. I thought, this is the coolest ending ever. And then the finished book came out, and they totally changed the ending of it, and it was totally different, and I was so disappointed. And to this day, I'm still disappointed.
Yeah, and you wonder how much of that was kind of, you know, a choice that was made.
And it was just a little-known author.
Marketplace.
Yeah.
You know, whether or not the readership or the marketplace is driving a decision like that, or whether it's the kind of integrity of the
I think it was they didn't want to leave the ending so badly. They wanted to have a happy ending. And believe it or not, it was a James Patterson book, actually. And it was one of the Alex Cross books, I think, actually, if I remember correctly. But I just remember thinking, that was so cool, what happened at the end. I can't wait to read the next book. And then they changed it, and I thought, oh, that sucks. I felt, it was like the end, remember the ending of Dallas where we thought that somebody had blown up in that building, but it all turned out to be a dream?
I thought that wasn't that the Who Shot J.R.?
Exactly.
After the J.R., okay.
And then Patrick Duffy came back in the shower, you know, and everything changed.
That's the man from Atlantis, you know?
One of the dumbest things they ever did on that show. I'm so stupid. I mean, it was like, well, wait a minute. How are they going? Because when that building blew up, I think Sue Ellen was in the building. You think, well, she's dead now. She has to be dead. And you know, how are they going to get? But it all turned out, and it was all so stupid. I don't know.
Well, that's that whole thing of, like, when you find out something was all a dream, how it cheats readers, you know, or it cheats viewers.
Oh, absolutely.
How can you be emotionally invested in something that you find out that, you know, was just a dream? Although there's a great book that does that, William Golding's Pincher Martin. It's an old book, but it's... Well, I just totally spoiled it for anybody who would read it. But
I don't think so.
Pincher Martin, it's one of these books that you find out in the end that it's all happening in his like last moments of consciousness, and this entire kind of story that occurs doesn't ever actually occur. And it works really well, or I loved it when I read it. But again, I I think most of the time you feel cheated at the end of something like that.
But then that sort of reminds me of the ending of Saint Elsewhere. I feel cheated to this day about the ending to that show.
And I don't even remember the ending of that. I think I stopped watching it by the time.
Well, if I tell the ending, nobody will want to watch it anymore, so maybe I better not.
Yeah, I'm not going to go on Netflix.
Well, actually, I don't think you can even get it on Netflix. The only season that's available is season one for some stupid reason.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and the weird thing is I just interviewed William Daniels, a terrific actor. He was on that show.
Oh, cool.
And he's not even sure where the other seasons are, so...
Well, I'm sure somebody's...
I think he told me that somebody...
making the buck off of them.
I think overseas bought them. Somebody overseas bought them and has the rights over there. That's why they're not available around here. I don't know. It's so stupid.
Okay.
It's like, just put them out. You know, just show them. People want to see this stuff, you know, and it's not... Why would you want to hide anything? So, are you working on another book now?
I am. I was working on it just an hour ago. I'm working on another literary mystery, and it's in a small town in rural central Washington, and
So it's not going to be what we term a cozy, then?
No, it's not a cozy. It's kind of a, I would say, again, it's kind of a literary mystery. I think I'm trying to do some things that are a little bit different, and I'm exploring those things right now. So I'm hesitant to talk too much about it. I'm not superstitious. I'm just kind of still exploring. So.
But will it be dark like this one?
I think that there is definitely some kind of rural noir elements to it. But I also think that there are some, from my perspective, there's some characters here who I think are pretty interesting, who I like writing about, and who are kind of fun and interesting people who have chosen to live in kind of a strange place for interesting reasons. So I think there's an upbeat element to it to hopefully balance out some of that darker stuff.
Now, have they done an audio of your book, Midnight Book?
Yeah, they did.
Really? Who does the audio?
Carolyn, maybe, I believe her name is. I have to confess, I have not yet listened to it, and it's not not for any particular reason, just out of time. I've heard that it's good, and I love audiobooks. I really do. I listen to a lot of audiobooks, but I have not yet listened to my own, so I will.
It's interesting that you say that. I mean, you think, doesn't the author listen? I guess you just assume they do. You just assume they've heard.
Well, it just came out, I think 3 weeks ago, and I've been hopping around doing some different bookstore gigs and that kind of thing. And I think part of it is that because I'm spending quite a lot of time reading the book out loud, I'd like to, shore up my own reading of it. It's not that conscious, but there's definitely a, I'm kind of holding off till I'm done doing some
reading. Well, what was that the first time you were in the bookstore reading from this book? How did that feel?
Oh, it was great. It was really great. I went back to the tattered cover and read from it. And so a lot of my kind of fellow booksellers, were there and just really kind of, it was just a great experience. I'm reading about Colfax Avenue while at a store that's on Colfax Avenue, and it was it just felt like art imitating life, imitating art, or some variation of that, and really kind of moving, and made me very nostalgic to be back at the bookstore and with my peeps.
Right. So you would, but you wouldn't read anything in that drawer for.
not right now.
No. I find that fascinating how self-conscious you are about some of your earlier works. It fascinates me. And Harlan Coben was the same way. He had two books that were never published. One was called, I think, Miracle Cure, and he didn't. I think they finally published them, but he didn't really want them published.
Yeah, I think, I don't know, you want, I kind of liken it to, even when I'm working on a draft of something, and my wife is a fantastic reader, she's a librarian, and she reads like crazy, and so I always give her things to read, and she'll ask me, are you ready for me to read it yet? And I really have to be ready for her to read it. I don't want to give it give it to somebody to read when I know that there are things that I need to fix. And I think that's because I don't want people to be distracted by those things.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it becomes more useful to me. And also, I think the first read of something is really important. So if I give it to her to read a chapter and there are all these problems in it or things that I know are flaws, then maybe she isn't seeing, you know, other things that I'm missing. So, yeah, does that help to kind of justify my self-consciousness at all?
Yeah, exactly. I think as a writer, you are self-conscious. You can't help it, especially when you're just starting out. You know, you don't know how people are going to react to your books. You know, you look at some of the Amazon reviews, and I just get horrified by some of the things I'm seeing. People saying, "I'll never read this author again," or "I'm done with this."
Yeah.
They wrote, there was a review of Patricia Cornwell's latest book, and they said, "I'm done with Patricia Cornwell. I'll never read her again. I'm sorry. I can't waste time." And I read the book, and I loved it. And I thought, well, maybe we didn't read the same book. You know?
And you got to wonder sometimes, like, are you just a knucklehead? Or is there, you know, not that, sometimes there are flaws and there are shortcomings in stories, of course, but sometimes people have, like, a level of animosity that you, when they're reviewing, that it makes you wonder if it's somehow personal.
Well, everybody knows that Patricia Cornwell's books are not the way, they're not written the way they used to be written. And she's definitely changed her tone, the tone of her books has definitely changed. But I love her characters, and I've always loved her characters, and that's why I will read the books. To me, that's enough. But that is not true of a lot of series. There are series that I have found have gotten very old, and I can't read them anymore. But I don't feel that way about her. I don't feel that way about her novels.
And right.
And
you have to wonder how much of it is expectations. Like your expectations are based on how much you connected with those earlier books. If it's not happening anymore, then you can't see it for what it is. You're seeing it in comparison to those earlier.
Well, that's right.
Books.
So do you have time to read a lot too, or are you too much into writing?
You know what? I read as much as I can. I'm an English teacher too. I teach at a community college. And so, unfortunately, during the school year, I tend to, you know, read what I'm teaching, which is great because I get to pick the books, but it does kind of, it limits my reading. You know, so every night before bed, I'm reading things for the classroom, which is, again, it's wonderful. It's not something to complain about because I'm still reading, and it's a job. You know, reading for a job, how fantastic is that? But at the same time, there is this, you know, I have the pile of, like, non-school books that I want to read, and that grows bigger and bigger and bigger every day. And so, you know, sometimes I always have to wait till the weekend or till, you know, I have a break over the holidays or something like that to catch up. Now, I still read, you know, I still kind of balance it out, but I don't read as much as much totally on my own choice as I would like to.
You know, it's interesting. I'm reading a first novel now. It's by a different publisher. It's HarperCollins. But I'm noticing little words that were left out of sentences. That drives me insane when I see that.
Uh-huh.
I think, why didn't somebody notice this when they were... And yet it happens.
It happens.
And then you think to yourself, well, why wouldn't the author look through these to make sure before... You know, and let them know. You'd think that the author would fine-tune it, but I guess the author doesn't always have time either. Or miss
it. I don't know if it's time. I think I would say that sometimes what happens is you get so used to a story or so used to your own voice that your brain is kind of filling in gaps in the sentence.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, if you were to take a word out of the first paragraph of this novel that I wrote, because I've read that first paragraph so many times, I may not see that. My brain is kind of spackling that, spackling over that gap. And
that's what I need to do. I need to have authors send me the arcs of their books and let me find them, because I love doing that.
There you go. there's a job of the copy editor waiting for you.
I think that would be cool. Because I hate when something's wrong in the sentence and I have to read it three times and I think, well, something's wrong in that sentence. Something's missing. There's a word missing, or they substituted another word, or there was a clause that should be in there that's not in there now, and it drives me nuts.
Yeah, yeah. And I think sometimes that happens despite people's best efforts. I really do. I think I can think of an example of a sentence missing that shouldn't have been, and it just...
And then there's right.
Yeah, and this is despite, you know, many read-throughs by many people, and still something slipped through.
Well, yeah, and you have to also...
So it happens, you know. Yeah.
You also have to wonder how many... The editors have more than one author, so you have to wonder... How many different books is my editor working on?
Right, and I think they work really, really hard. We got to forgive them a little bit. Forgive everybody a little bit for that stuff, I would say.
Yeah, I guess you really do have to. But so you're not even at the title stage of your new book yet.
No. Yes, but no.
You have a tentative title.
I have a working title, but I'm not sure if that's going to be it.
Now, will it be published by Scribner?
I don't know at this stage.
Oh, really?
No, I'm still in the process of working on it, so we shall see.
Well, I didn't know. A lot of times when an author has one book, they've already signed a 2 or 3 book contract, and sometimes that happens. I see that.
Yeah, that didn't happen with me and my contract, and so so we'll see where it goes. Right now, I'm focusing on the story,
which is what you should be doing. That's exactly right.
Yeah, but, yeah. There are a lot of distractions out there, so yeah.
So what? After you're done the book, you send it to your agent, and then see what happens. Is that the way it usually works?
And then he reads it, and we'll see what happens from there.
And so, then he calls you, and he tells you every little thing he doesn't like about the book.
Right. then we have to talk. Yeah.
You have to. I guess it's as the agent, you have to be honest with you have to be. If you're not honest, yeah, you're only doing them a disservice.
Yeah, and I would just say, you know, my agent has been really fantastic. He's just a really smart guy and a smart reader, and so I've trusted his judgment so far, and I think that we've done well together. You know, we have a good working relationship and good friendship. So.
Well, I think what's great about you is you. I can tell you're neurotic, and I think that's wonderful because I think you have to be as a writer. I think it makes you a better writer because you realize when you've done something wrong and what you have to change, what you have to fix, and I think that's great. And
I think, you know, I don't know how much of it is being neurotic. I definitely have neurotic elements, my personality, but I also think that some of it is just being, you know, kind of driven by story. I think, you know, you do what's best for the story. And so if somebody gives you advice that's best for the story, you take it. If it means, you know, you cut out things on your own or at the suggestion of other people that you know are going to be best for the story, or that you're willing to explore as being best for the story, I think you got to do it.
Well, what if it's your mother-in-law that says it, and you hate your mother-in-law? Do you just ignore what she says?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, you pick your readers, you pick the people you trust, and
It's interesting. There's a story. I was when Lisa Scottolini was first starting out. She's very, very famous now. She came to our book club in Broomall, Pennsylvania, and we were sitting around. There was probably about 10 of us, and we had this guy in our group, and he had a list of things he didn't like about her book, and he proceeded to tell her everything that he didn't like about this book. Do you know? I don't know who was more humiliated, her or us.
Right. Did she handle it okay?
Oh, yeah, very, very well.
Yeah, good. I think there's an element of thick skin that you have to have is when you put something out there in the world for other people to read or to examine. I mean, you're putting your blog out there and your podcast, and, you know, there's an element of when you share something, you're making yourself vulnerable. You're opening yourself up to be judged by other people.
I love that. I love that. I want people to write to me and say, you know, I hated what you said last night. I hated that question. Or why did you ask Dennis Lehane about his marriage? Which I really did. That really did happen. And you
oh,
know,
really?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I got a call from his publicist saying, you need to take that out of there. We need to get that rid of that. because he really was sensitive about it at the time.
Yeah.
And but it, you know, those things happen. Sometimes you ask questions and you don't know what the answer is, and maybe you don't know it's a sensitive issue. It does happen with authors. Authors are just like any other people. They're sensitive about certain things.
Yeah, sure. And, I mean, and a lot of times when you make yourself vulnerable, you also kind of unearth things about yourself or just get into more interesting territory in a conversation.
But, I mean, to get any feedback at all is wonderful. I mean, you're always going to have those people that don't like something. And, you know, they're just
right.
You just have to accept that. And you say, well, maybe you get something out of the next one I do. Who knows, you know?
Yeah. And have the right attitude about
it. Now, you have a podcast, too?
No.
You have something?
No, I have nothing.
Your publicist told me something about that I was going to be on something that you were doing, some kind of a.
I don't know what that was in reference.
Really? Interesting.
Yeah, I don't do a podcast or anything. I write and I teach and I raise my kids and I.
What was she? That's weird. Now I'm getting weirded out because she told me something about the fact that I was going to be on some show of yours or you were gonna put it on something to get it. That's strange.
I don't know.
I'm going to have to forward her email to you because now I'm like weirded out because now I don't know what to say.
Yeah.
Now I feel stupid for even bringing it up because I don't know what I'm talking about. People are going to think I'm sitting here drinking or something and that I lost my mind.
No, it's all right.
But it's like now I have to go back and read it again to see what's going on.
I'm sorry, I can't help you there.
Yeah, well, I'll send you an email and we'll get it straightened out after the show's over. Of course, everybody out there is saying, we won't even hear it. What do you mean?
Right.
So you would love to write like a novel, say a novel a year for the rest of your life. That would make you happy?
Yeah, you know, I really like teaching, so I would like to do both, but also there's you know, time is always an issue. So, yeah, but I love writing. So I don't know about a novel a year. I don't know if I'm that kind of a writer. I like to write, and I tend to always have something else to work on. I don't really get writer's block, but I might have some days where it's a real slog, a lot of days where it's a real slog, but I tend to, you know, that tends to happen kind of on a level of themes and not on a level of ideas. I tend to have
stories
in the back of my mind. Yeah.
It's interesting you talk about that because Donald Winslow was talking about that recently, how he says he's had days where he'll write two sentences and throw them out at the end of the day.
That's pretty incredible given how prolific he's been.
And he's so, you can tell, and I said to him that how I knew how successful his new book was going to be. It's a terrific book, and I think it's really going to sell well.
I'm not ready yet.
But then he...
Yeah.
Oh, God, you really should. Why haven't you read it? That's amazing.
I know. Now I feel berated for it.
Let me tell you this. Every curse word there is in existence is in that book. So.
I'll read it to my kids then.
No, please don't do that.
I heard, what's the quote I heard about it?
It's the Force.
The Godfather of...
That's exactly what it is.
Godfather of the Police Force or something like that. Like, which is a great kind of, that's a great line.
No, please don't read it out loud to your kids. Your wife will kill me.
I wouldn't do that.
There is a lot of cursing in the book. And it's sort of like, and meeting him, Don Winslow is a very interesting character. Very, very interesting character. If you ever get a chance to meet him, go up and say hello to him because he's fascinating. As are you.
Yeah, I'd love to.
I mean, what comes across with you, Matthew, is your sense of humor. I hear it. In your voice, I know that you're very humor. I know you like humor. I can tell.
Yeah, I do. And now that you said that, I'm gonna proceed to like be totally unfunny.
No.
So there, see.
But when you worked at Brookline Booksmith, did you have? Did you have like, I don't want to say bums because they're not really. I don't know that I would classify these people as bums. But did you have people that? Homeless people that would stay in the store?
Sure, yeah. There and at the Tyler Cover.
Both of them? Okay.
And I wouldn't say, you know, you go into... So talking to the Boston Public Library, for example, the main branch there, off Copley Square, and, you know, I would see a lot of homeless people hanging out, and again, that's kind of the role that libraries have played. And I think bookstores, to an extent, play a similar role, but, you know, it is a business, and I think maybe the space is more limited and so on. But absolutely, you know, I think at both stores, there is a sense, like I said, that bookstores are often the hub of a community and often have kind of an open door policy. And so, yeah, people come in and you know, at both stores, there are chairs sitting around. Header cover had, you know, a couch every 15 feet. Not literally, but it's a place that encourages people to park it and read and sit.
And I don't want to say waste time, but they certainly while away the time there sometimes. Yeah,
sure,
absolutely.
Sure, kind of dawdle about, you know. And I think that, you know, of course, that can sometimes bring in some unsavory elements, but by and large, people, I think, you know, are taking advantage of that and feeling kind of comfortable there. And I think it's important.
The only issue
that they play.
Yeah, I remember when I worked at the bookstore. With the issues, most people are very respectful, but then you get those people who, like, we had a couch there at our store, and somebody was sticking chicken bones down the couch. And it's like, there's always somebody who ruins it for everybody else.
There's always
that one person, sometimes it's a couple. We also had a woman that would come in and she did things in the bathroom that were just awful. But, you know, or left it in a very bad place. And, you know, it's people like that, you just want to grab them and say, what is the matter with you?
Yeah. What are you thinking?
But
at the Tatter Cover, for example, Tatter Cover was big on First Amendment and providing materials, and so we carried like Playboy and Penthouse and Hustler and that kind of stuff in our magazine section. And it was, you know, weekly we'd find a copy in the bathroom and then in the bathroom stalls. And, you know, it's a bookstore. You know, I don't know. So exactly. Some people just, I don't know.
If you could just root those people out and straighten them out, you know, it would be better, I think. But you're never going to.
Yeah, but, you know, but you're not going to. But, and I think the wonderful thing about so many bookstores is that they kind of try to be benevolent despite that, you know. Say and kind of recognize that, well, that's that guy. He's going to do that. But you know what? The other 99 people here aren't. And so let's not change our rules or let's not change our attitude just because of that person. And that's pretty remarkable. I think there's a level of idealism there that is kind of rare. That again, you maybe don't find at Walmart. You know?
Yeah.
So. Yeah,
it can be a real pain in the neck sometimes. But you know, you have to when you work at a bookstore, you see some things like that. And it's sad, but it's there, and you deal with it, and you move on,
right.
Because the enjoyment more people get out of the people that don't get any enjoyment is what makes it worthwhile.
Right, and people surprise you too, where maybe you know, assume something about the guy who comes in and smells really bad or something like that. But then he starts talking about poetry and blows your mind, you know? I found that a lot of times customers were kind of surprised me.
Well, there was that bookstore recently I was reading about. They said they're going to have to close because business was down. Well, the next week they doubled their sales, they said. So now they're staying open another month.
Oh, really? That's cool.
And I thought, well, that's neat, but how long is that going to go on? Are they just doing it out of sympathy and the sympathy is going to wear off? Or will that keep going? Will people start to say, well, if we don't go here, we're going to lose it?
Yeah. Well, it's a choice. You know, I mean, as consumers, we make a choice where we're going to shop.
Now you're in.
If we want a bookstore in our neighborhood, then we got to shop at that bookstore.
You live in Washington?
Yes. Yep.
So are you near Powell's?
Powell's is in Portland, so they're about 5 hours away, and
I'm
in rural Washington. So we're in a kind of a unique place where we have a a small bookstore here in town, and I think it's the only bookstore, the only place that sells new books in the county, and it's a big county. And it's just by necessity had to kind of over many different owners basically go turn more into a coffee shop than a bookstore, just because it's a small town, and I think a lot of small towns businesses have to adjust to the shortage of
Do they have your book?
They do. Yeah, they have my book. And there are the other bookstores in the region. I think the next closest bookstores are about 75 miles away. There are a couple of them, and these are all pretty small. So, that was a pretty tough thing to adjust to, because we've always, my wife and I have, I met my wife at Tattered Cover. She was a bookseller there for 10 years.
Really?
And she's a librarian now. And bookstores have been just a really important part of our lives and our relationship. And so we hit the road now, and really everywhere we go, we go to the bookstore. We find the independent bookstore, and we head in, and our kids stock up, and we get enough books to tide us over for, till the next trip. And
what was your wife's first reaction to your book? I'm curious when it was finished.
She read it through various stages of it. And she's a great reader. She, like I said, she reads a lot, and so she's a great critic, and she'd be very frank and say, I just don't think that this part is believable, but she's very supportive. Yeah.
But I don't remember any parts like that in the book. I thought the book was maybe you took them out since then.
Yeah. I took a lot out.
But I don't remember anything in the book that didn't seem believable. In fact, it seemed very believable.
That's nice.
That's one of the nice things I like about the book.
Cool.
It's definitely.
I think it's what you're reading is kind of the greatest hits of many drafts. That's kind of how I think about it.
Readers forget that sometimes, that writers have drafts. First, second. How many?
25.
You really have that many?
Yeah, I don't know if it's that many, but yeah.
enough that it's annoying after a while, right?
It's enough that I lost count, yeah. I think it took me a little over three years to write the first draft. You got to keep in mind that I have a full-time job and kids and all the rest of that. And then another probably 3 or 4 years of revisions and rewriting, and then dead time, where it was almost in that drawer, but not quite.
Wow, that sounds...
Yeah, so it's been a long process, it really has. It's good to hear that, it's good to hear that it worked out for you as a reader.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's cool.
I see that what comes of that, all that hard work and the pleasure I got out of reading it, it's all worthwhile for you and for me.
Wow, that's awesome. Thank you. Surely that's a really nice one.
Well, this has been a great interview. I really enjoyed it, Matthew. You're really a fun guy, and you make me laugh, and I like that. I like
oh,
writers
cool.
that make
you
me
make
laugh.
You make me laugh, too. It's been a great conversation.
Yeah, it's just been a lot of fun. And the book, again, is called Midnight at the Bright Ideas Bookstore, and it's a novel, and it's out from Scribner, and it is a mystery, so don't worry about that. And this has been David's Book Talk, and we'll talk to you next time.
You have just enjoyed the podcast of David's Book Talk, brought to you by your host, book lover David English. Please visit us at davidsbooktalk.com, follow us on Facebook and Twitter, and subscribe to our podcast. We want to hear from you, and we don't want you to miss our upcoming shows with top authors like Mary Higgins Clark, Patricia Cornwell, Lisa Scottolini, Jackie Collins, Nelson DeMille, Michael Connelly, Sue Grafton, Steve Martini, Dale Brown, David Baldacci.